From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Karen Hughes, Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs and one of the last of the president's Texas loyalists in the inner circle, has resigned. Here's Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice on Wednesday.
When I asked Karen to come, I asked her to come and to help us make public diplomacy strong and central to the mission of transformational diplomacy, and she has done that. She's done it in spectacular fashion.
Heck of a job, Hughesy. She's the third after Charlotte Beers and Margaret Tutwiler to fail at improving America's image abroad. According to Pew Research Center numbers cited in the news this week, favorable views of the U.S. are scraping the bottom, as low as 21% in Egypt, 15% in Pakistan, 13% in the Palestinian territories, and a lowly 9% in Turkey. But she did spectacularly double the budget. Price Floyd was the director of media affairs under Hughes. He knows the job and the mission. We asked him to grade her job performance.
I'll give her a B on energy and getting funding, but she'll have to get an F on actually changing the perception of the U.S. overseas.
That's depressing.
You know, one of the things that she had coming in that everyone said was this clout, that she had the president's ear. And now some people are saying, look, she had an impossible job. No one could have done it. But she can't have it both ways. She can't have come in under the guise of, look, I'm the person who has the president's ear. I can call him up and I can make things happen. And in fact, everyone tells one story of when she was meeting with Palestinians in Gaza, and she called the president up right there and said, you've got to meet with these people when they come to Washington. And he agreed. So if she has that kind of clout, why didn't that turn into any actual changes? You know, she could have easily told the president, we need to close Guantanamo. I don't know if she did or not, but it's certainly not closed.
Hughes established something called the Rapid Reaction Unit. What's that all about?
That was part of her effort to try to hit back in the same news cycle in foreign markets on news stories that the State Department deemed as incorrect or false. The idea was to put people on right after a report came out on Al Jazeera, put someone who spoke Arabic to push back on bad news stories or incorrect news stories.
Apart from putting out little brush fires before they had a chance to become, wildfires, any reason to think that the Rapid Reaction Unit was successful?
I'm not sure. When it first started up, one of the things they asked for was a report on how many interviews people had done as part of this Rapid Reaction Unit. And the first report came back was 13 pages of interviews done by our ambassadors and other people at embassies in Europe and in Arab countries. You know, 70, 80 interviews. But if there was any impact, it hasn't been seen in any poll numbers. Both the Pew and the BBC polls that are done show a continued downward trend in the perception overseas. So I think at the most it did was put out a few brush fires.
Whenever the subject of America's public diplomacy comes up, someone invokes the truism, nothing kills a bad product faster than good advertising. And you have said on this show and elsewhere, problem isn't so much how we go about trying to influence others, but the underlying policies themselves. And you have a pretty long checklist of what it is about America's behavior in the world that inflames public opinion far beyond Karen Hughes' ability to influence it. What's on your checklist?
The biggest one is Guantanamo. The pictures that appear on Al Jazeera and all the other pan-Arab stations does us no end of ill will. That's one. Another issue that we could take quick action on is climate change. If we were seen to actively participate in discussions on limiting greenhouse gases, I think that would go a long ways to diffusing some of the negative perceptions of the U.S. overseas. There's a whole list of other things, even HIV/AIDS. The substances, we've done more than anyone else this administration has to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS. And yet, because we're doing it alone, we're not doing it with the UN and others, we get bad grades on it.
Will the president be able to fill this job? Who wants this gig?
Well, I'm not sure who wants it. I hope the president chooses someone much in the vein of Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, who had been a critic of the administration's Iraq policies. Therefore, when he came in as Secretary of Defense, he had a credibility on this issue and therefore others that someone who was simply a loyal Bush follower did not. What we need is someone who's willing to push the bureaucracy, come up with new ideas, and stand up and call out policies that are being harmful to our public diplomacy efforts.
Price, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Price Floyd, former Director of Media Affairs under Karen Hughes, is now Director of External Relations for the Center for New American Security.
People worried about public health have been talking about drug-resistant diseases for years and trying to get news outlets to report on them. A recent study in a scientific journal has thrust the issue into the public eye, but while experts are glad the issue is finally getting attention, they're not all sure it's the right kind of attention. From WNYC, Fred Mogul reports.
News coverage of serious illness often works like the common cold. There are a few early symptoms. They spread. They linger. They generally just go away on their own. Sometimes it's clear what causes a wave of stories.
It's the big scare tonight. He has a highly contagious disease that two members of his family already died from, and you may have come very close to this man.
And sometimes it's more difficult to pinpoint. There's just something going around.
Avian flu in Asia, it's killed 65 there so far, but the United Nations says a flu pandemic could kill 5 million to 150 million worldwide.
For the past few weeks, it's been MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. Its origin as a news phenomenon is fairly clear. Although it's been around for years, a report in the October 17th issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association triggered a veritable outbreak of coverage.
We begin with a health alert that the CDC right now is calling a major public health problem. It's concern over drug-resistant staph infection.
Because it can be a scary, indiscriminate, and silent killer.
An Eastern Kentucky school district is being shut down on Monday to disinfect facilities following a confirmed case of that drug-resistant staph infection.
The bacteria, which is resistant to common antibiotics, is known as MRSA.
The medical journal was the first to detail the prevalence of MRSA nationwide. The bottom line, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in 2005, MRSA caused more than 94,000 infections and nearly 19,000 deaths in the United States, most of them associated with healthcare settings, and most of them preventable. Glenn Nowak, the CDC's communications director, says they figured there'd be widespread interest, and they didn't have a hard time guessing what name might be bestowed on the bacterium.
Some in the media like to characterize MRSA as a superbug, and so they wanted to make sure that people understand that the vast majority of these infections were more on the mild versus the severe end.
To be a bona fide superbug, MRSA would have to be a lot more fierce, with almost no drugs working on it and a higher proportion of the infected dying of it. The New York Times did call MRSA a superbug, but they did so only once out of several stories and only in a broader piece about people's drug-resistant disease anxieties. The Times deputy news editor, Philip Corbett, oversees the paper's style book.
It's a scary word and maybe is a little over the top. What you really want to do in trying to inform people about an issue like that is to really try to take a step back and a deep breath and be very sober and thoughtful in how you do it.
For the sober Times, this meant stressing a couple important distinctions while reporting the story of Omar Rivera. The 12-year-old Brooklyn boy made national headlines when he died of a drug-resistant infection after being sent home by a hospital with inadequate medication to fight the disease. It's not clear how Rivera was infected, but it wasn't in a hospital. That's unusual. Community-acquired staph infections are much less frequent and generally much less lethal than hospital-acquired ones. Many reporters glossed over this.
Brooklyn mother plans to sue the city and a local hospital for $25 million after a drug-resistant superbug killed her son.
She said Kings County Hospital gave Omar Rivera allergy medicine and sent him home 2 days before he died.
It could have been linked to the superbug, and they say it could have been prevented.
The effect, says Shannon Brownlee, senior fellow at the New American Foundation, is making the world seem scarier than it is, and distracting people from the real zone of scariness.
I can't imagine what it must be like to have your child die of any reason, including a terrible infection. But to fail to say, look, the community-acquired kind is different from the hospital-acquired kind, and in fact, the hospital-acquired one is the big problem. I think it sort of flames parental fears without actually getting people to worry about the thing they really should worry about, which is why aren't hospitals doing something about this infection?
Brownlee is the author of Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. She says for a while we've been going through cycles of forgetting and then rediscovering that antibiotics are not cure-alls. She recalls this magazine article back in the 80s.
And the story was that these superbugs were appearing. And it was the first time anybody had really said, uh-oh, you know those great antibiotics that we have? They're not working anymore. And I think this was kind of a loss of innocence. I mean, we sort of saw medicine as being all-powerful until that point.
Brownlee thinks the MRSA coverage could lead news audiences to miss the forest for the trees, namely that MRSA is just one of many infections you can get in the hospital, fatal and otherwise. Dr. Don Goldman agrees that some of the nuances are being missed in the coverage, but he thinks overall there's no such thing as bad publicity where drug-resistant bacteria are concerned.
On the one hand, I could easily argue that a lot of the media attention has been a bit over the top and has created a sense of anxiety that may be out of proportion to the magnitude of the problem compared to all other problems. But it certainly is another force or pressure to get folks to pay attention.
Goldman is a Harvard researcher and clinician and a leader of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. He has more confidence than Brownlee in the public's MRSA attention span.
This has been a building crest of a wave for a while now, and I don't think there's going to be a retreat from the efforts to reduce MRSA. It's too fully ingrained in the consciousness of leadership in hospitals and, in fact, in legislative agenda and probably eventually in national reporting requirements.
But Goldman and Brownlee do agree on one thing, that there is a cheap and easy remedy, fanatical hand washing, especially in hospitals. For On the Media, I'm Fred Mogul.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's been a busy week for the FCC and its chairman, Kevin Martin. On Wednesday, the commission held a sixth and final public hearing on media consolidation and its effects on local news coverage. The chairman seeks to relax a rule which prohibits media giants from owning both a broadcast station and a newspaper in the same area. Also this week, the FCC tackled competition in the cable industry, ruling that apartment building operators can no longer enter into exclusive contracts with cable companies. The new ruling even nullifies current cable contracts struck through those exclusive deals. John Egerton is the Washington Bureau Chief for Broadcasting and Cable magazine. He explains the implications of the FCC's pro-competition cable ruling.
The FCC ruled that cable companies and building owners, apartment and condo owners, can't strike exclusive deals for video programming and other services. Comcast says that, and they're the largest cable operator, that that's going to affect something like, 2.5 million customers. And what it means to, like, telephone companies and competitors to cable is that they get to go in and try to compete and try to sign up these buildings for their service.
2.5 million ain't nothing. That's 10% of Comcast's customer base. Does this presage some sort of more gimlet-eyed regulatory view of cable operators and their penchant for monopoly markets?
I'm not sure, at least from the FCC's position, that you can get more gimlet-eyed than they are. I mean, essentially, Kevin Martin frequently will invoke the doubling of cable rates, and the thrust of his commission really has been to open up cable to competition, to try to get cable to unbundle its services, and at several points to give consumers, viewers, more choice and more control over their programming. And I think this is all part of that.
Now, the commission also held hearings on a long-standing issue of media ownership and the consolidation of media. They focused on the issue of localism. Tell me about what localism is all about, please, and what was the thrust of the hearing?
Localism has several facets. Is your radio station, for instance, operated by a local broadcaster? Is it owned by a large corporation somewhere else? Is there somebody actually on site? That's one part. Local news is, I think, a very important part of that, particularly for people who are against media consolidation, because they say if a newspaper and a TV station are allowed to be owned in the same market, that sometimes local news is actually decreased rather than increased, and that local news tends to be it bleeds, it leads, or tabloid for the sake of eyeballs, as opposed to, you know, public affairs, community service, local elections, news that you can use from a local viewer's perspective. I think that's what incited the passions at the localism hearing that was held this week at the FCC headquarters.
Yeah, it was pretty passionate. It at some points began to look like an episode of Let's Make a Deal. People in the audience in colorful costumes, tell me about them.
Well, yes, there was the woman with the pink crown, though I never could figure out exactly what she was for or against. But there were the cheerleaders that had FCC emblazoned on their chest and were leading anti-consolidation cheers like, you know, 2, 4, 6, 8, who do we consolidate? Media, media, media. And it drew a chuckle or two and a lot of photographers. But there was also a lot of serious concern about a number of issues, from minority ownership to the degradation of women through hip-hop, to a lack of local news, to a loss of jobs. The localism hearings, they've had several, and they've also had several media ownership hearings around the country, and they often draw passion and people from all walks of life, from, you know, students to professors to people walking off the street saying, this is important to me and I just wanted to say something.
What is Chairman Martin's take on media consolidation at this point? Is he, as you suggested in your blog, the ghost of Michael Powell, or is he forging his own agenda?
Well, I think he's forging his own agenda because he's got a lot of other things to worry about. The DTV transition is a huge item to deal with.
And that's digital TV mandated for virtually all broadcasters sometime in 2009.
Yes. He's got the a la carte, which is his major issue, unbundling cable's programming either at the wholesale or at the consumer level. I think he believes that the media should be allowed to consolidate, because I think he agrees that there's much more competition than there were when the rules were originally written, that there's cable, that there's satellite, that there's the internet, and he believes that those voices should be counted. Now, I think he's also a realist. He has a Democratic Congress to oversee him. So I believe, as a realist, I think he would accept some modified version of the rule to allow newspapers and TV stations to be owned in the same market. At the end of the day, he will try to craft rules that allow broadcasters to be what I believe he thinks is more competitive in an increasingly competitive marketplace.
All right, John. Well, as always, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bob.
John Egerton is the Washington Bureau Chief for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine.
40 years ago, the death of Ernesto Che Guevara at the age of 39 marked the end of his high-profile career as a revolutionary. It also marked the beginning of his role as an icon of anti-Americanism and/or defiant martyrdom and/or countercultural chic. Biographer John Lee Anderson says that Che's enduring appeal has its roots in the universal drama of his life, beginning with his formative years as an Argentine medical student rejecting a privileged birthright after a road trip opened his eyes.
He dreamed of doing something great for mankind. The more he traveled in Latin America, the more indignant he became over what he saw as social injustice and many of the diseases that he had originally wanted to cure, he began to trace to political domination by the United States. He became a Marxist looking for a cause. He found that cause when he met Fidel Castro in Mexico in 1955 and joined his revolution to overthrow the Cuban dictator Batista. He turned out to be a better fighter than he was a doctor. He went off to lead new revolutions, first in the Congo and finally in Bolivia. It was there in Bolivia that the CIA mounted an operation with the Green Berets and the Bolivian army to capture Che. He was wounded, captured, and then executed, thereby creating Che the myth.
Now, you wrote your book about 10 years ago as a wave of Che branding was in full swing. How was he depicted then?
My book coincided with a resurgence of interest in him. When it came out in 97, I was in New York, a bookstore. They wanted me to sign books. And when I went in there, I noticed that the cover of my book had been hung as a large poster in the window. The manager came over and virtually embraced me and said, "How great that you've come. Every day we get 20 to 30 people coming in. Some of them want to buy your book, but most of them want to buy the poster." And he even said that he had had a guy the day before that had come in and said, "I want that guy, C-H-E. He didn't even know who he was or how to pronounce the name. He looks hip. He looks cool. He looks like a rebel. By wearing him on your T-shirt, you're saying that you're not happy with the way things are in society." I wrote my book by and large as a response to what I felt was a dearth of information about him. I tried to set the record straight, to try to demythify the man.
What was the principal myth or myths that you were trying to dispel?
One of the initial impulses that led me to Che in the first place, I found Che very much alive in the battlefronts of the world. This at a time when he was not in anybody's T-shirt. Back at the end of the 80s, early 90s, I found students in Burma in the jungle reading his 1961 manual on guerrilla warfare. I found Afghan Mujahideen who talked admiringly of Che. These were anti-communists. I talked to one of the CIA men who tracked him down who said he admired him. I couldn't think of another contemporary figure who had managed to assemble such a degree of fascination and even admiration, including from his ideological foes.
So tell me then, what do you think is the most difficult detail about the life of Che for those who would mythologize him to swallow?
Well, when I'm around people who get a little too warm and fuzzy over Che and who begin to talk lyrically about his humanism, I always like to point out the speech he made in which he talks about embracing the atomic cloud if necessary in order to change mankind. It always makes them blanch and they don't know what to say. The actual story of his life shows that that remained in rhetoric at a very doctrinaire moment. And actually in the field towards the end of his life, he was not as severe at all as he had been, say, in the early years of the Cuban Revolution.
Sounds like he lived up to the myth.
In essence, Che deserves his mythology. This questing young man who gave up his birthright in order to live what is arguably a miserable and dangerous existence, rightly or wrongly, to change the world, and then died trying to do it. Myths are made out of this. It's not unlike the myth of Icarus.
It's the myth of Icarus. It's also the myth in the minds of many of Osama bin Laden.
Mm.
I mean, is one generation's revolutionary, another's terrorist, or is he still as embraced as ever?
Lately, I've noticed there's an effort to revisit Che and to look at him with a more critical eye over his having presided over executions in Cuba, and that he famously described the United States as the enemy of humanity. I do find it interesting, the analogy between, say, Osama bin Laden today and Che Guevara yesterday. If you take away the Islamist content, and it's difficult to, from Osama bin Laden, there is something uncannily reminiscent about the stories. There is one fundamental difference, and that is that Che ambushed and fired at uniformed men also carrying weapons. Osama bin Laden's instrument of war is terrorism.
On the 40th anniversary of his death, has time or distance added some nuance or depth to his story, or have they merely flattened it to make it even more suitable for posters and T-shirts?
There's two things going on here. There's no doubt that, yes, he is merchandised cynically. In the first world, you are what you wear, and you don't actually have to do anything. It's in the third world that when you see someone perhaps raising a banner with Che, that there might be some actual political content or promise of action behind it. Che has become someone who can be used at will. A friend of mine was in Berlin not long ago and came across a neo-Nazi march with a banner of Che, and she walked up rather trepidatiously to the lead neo-Nazi, and she asked him, you know, what in God's name he was doing heralding Che Guevara. And he said, Che was a nationalist. She said, well, no, he wasn't. He was a Marxist. And he said, no, he wasn't. He was a nationalist like us. He's our hero, too.
John, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
John Lee Anderson is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of Che. When your lips say no, do your brainwaves say yes? Inquiring advertisers want to know, so they're looking to add biological monitoring to their focus groups. One company that provides the probes, the California-based M-Sense Corporation. Alyssa Moses is its chief analytics officer.
You go to a doctor and the doctor asks you some cognitive questions like, how are you feeling? You say, well, I've got a headache, I'm a little dizzy. That's important information, but it's oftentimes the blood pressure test or the blood test that really brings the whole picture together. It's the missing piece to the diagnosis that we haven't been able to have before.
M-Sense has streamlined the monitoring technology, giving it a leg up in the relatively new field of biological advertising. All it takes is a souped-up headband. That's what I wore when M-Sense co-founders Tim Hong and Hans Lee tested my physical responses to a couple of ads.
So you adjust the band with Velcro. Would you help me with this, Tim?
Yeah, just slip it on just like a headband. The key thing is that these two electrodes mm-hmm. need to be right on the forehead. Exactly.
Like that. And then
exactly. Tighten it.
Tighten it up. Okay. So with the two electrodes, and there's a sensor in the front, and there's a clip on my ear, you'll be able to measure, Tim.
Yeah, so what we're measuring is brainwaves, heart activity, blinking, breathing, motion. We're combining that into a model of how people respond to media.
And with that, I was set up to reveal my deepest, innermost response to a Lysol commercial.
Fact, millions of germs thrive on your kitchen surfaces, but if you're cleaning them with an overused sponge, you might as well be doing this.
As I watched, Tim and Hans monitored the peaks and valleys of my emotions in the form of a wavy blue line on a laptop. Comparing my response with a database of others, they figured what my body liked and didn't like about the commercial.
Life demands Lysol. That's a fact.
Okay, that was gross. She was cleaning a counter with a piece of chicken, and so that's what I thought about it. Now let's see what I felt about it.
Yeah, and there's quite a strong negative response to the chicken showing up on the screen.
When it really drops below the scale, what's happening then?
Let's play through this.
All right, so now it's dropping
Lysol
to nothing.
Sanitizing wipes are unbeatable because
okay.
they kill 99.9%
of... Oh, the bugs. Or whatever those things are. That was revolting.
That entire portion you...
Obviously, I didn't enjoy the commercial, but sometimes ads aren't meant to be enjoyed. In fact, quite the opposite. Tim Hong.
Some of the most effective advertising uses negative emotion to really make people think about their lives and the problems they have. There's great examples from Tide where there's a lot of negative emotion around stains and all the problems of life, and Tide comes in to be the hero.
Tim says that's why the ads for the job site Career Builder are so effective.
Hey, guys. Guys. Just thought you might want to know, sales aren't up. They're down.
They strike at the heart of something many of us grapple with, job anxiety. Working with monkeys, you know. Anyway, the ad worked on me pretty much the way it works on everybody.
Want a new job? We've got the most. CareerBuilder.com. A better job awaits.
Let's bring up your response. We could see that there's several large spikes. There's actually a lot of positive emotion in it, but also a lot of negative emotions during these job pain moments. There's one right over here where his boss tells him to dance, and you can see that.
Want a new job? We've got the most.
That is a very typical response. I think what's really powerful about Career Builder is that it does actually create that need of wanting a new job, that negative emotion. I remember what my Monday was like, and that's what they're able to do, is create that negative and positive emotion, but also leave it on a positive note.
We like it, we hate it, a little, a lot, changing from moment to moment. Our bodies don't lie. I asked M-Sense's Alyssa Moses if she considered how the technology, as intimate as it is, might be abused. She didn't buy it.
There's nothing wrong with trying to persuade people in a free economy, whether you're trying to persuade them to buy something, persuade them to buy your ideology, to vote for you. You lay your argument out on the table. All we can do is help people be as effective as they possibly can in what they're communicating. But at the end of the day, if you're selling something that people don't want, if you don't have a benefit that's compelling or an image that people want to identify with, No sale.
But consider how M-Sense technology could be applied. For instance, it could be used to test and train soldiers. In fact, it's been reported that the Army's been in touch with M-Sense, although no one from M-Sense would comment on that. And of course, we are in the midst of a presidential campaign, and I can't imagine any group of people more interested in how their message makes the American heart pound than the candidates. M-Sense has been testing the headband during presidential debates for their own research and development. For now.
Up next, the gangster, his mall, the scribe, and a trial, and why we love the web. No, I mean really love the web.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Who needs Hollywood writers when you have Brooklyn? In Kings County, New York, last week, the district attorney's office was busy building its case against retired FBI agent Roy Lindley DeVecchio, who, the state argued, conspired in four murders spanning 8 years in the 1980s and 90s. The trial had it all. Gangland-style murders, the infamous Columbo crime family, and a mob mistress named Linda Shiro, who was the prosecution's star witness. Shiro claimed, quite convincingly on the stand, by all accounts, that Agent DeVecchio passed information about the victims to Mafia capo Greg Scarpa. And then the surprise bombshell. Village Voice reporter Tom Robbins showed up on Wednesday morning with two cassette tapes, the contents of which left the prosecution no choice but to drop all the charges against DeVecchio. Robbins joins us now to talk about why he produced those tapes when 10 years ago he promised his source he wouldn't. Tom, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Briefly, give me the cast of characters here.
Well, the biggest character was not in the room. He's dead since 1994, and that was a fellow named Greg Scarpa Sr., who I met back in the early 90s when I was a reporter at the Daily News. Scarpa was a legendary figure in the South Brooklyn streets of Bensonhurst, where he was a swaggering character who everybody knew had killed many people and who was the loan shark to the loan sharks and the numbers bank for the numbers and who had his fingers in just about every crime that was going on.
And the defendant, Lynn DeVecchio.
Lynn DeVecchio was a veteran FBI agent. In fact, he used to look like Greg Scarpa a little bit. He used to have a big handlebar mustache and long curly hair and wear double-breasted suits, and he's toned down that image a little bit. He retired a few years ago, but he was tasked starting in the late 1960s to concentrate on New York's five organized crime families, and he became a specialist in Scarpa's family, the Columbo crime family.
And finally, Linda Shiro, the mob moll who was the star witness.
She was a teenager in Bensonhurst when she met Greg Scarpa. I don't know who swept who off their feet. Part of what she said on the stand was that when she first met him in a bar called the Flamingo, Scarpa said, "If you were mine, I'd air condition your subway car." That was before New York City cars were air conditioned.
Oh, that's so sweet.
She was a button-nosed brunette, very attractive, a very sweet and unassuming way about her, and an accent that was straight out of My Cousin Vinny.
And now the accusation was that DeVecchio had crossed the line from cultivating Scarpa as an FBI informant into actually participating in mob activities, including murder.
Four murders. There were four counts of murder in this indictment. That's what it consisted of. DeVecchio was charged with having told Scarpa about the identities of three people who were claimed to be informants and one who was becoming so drug-addled that DeVecchio told Scarpa he's going to be a threat to you, you'd better get rid of him.
And DeVecchio's interest in warning Scarpa about this, what was allegedly in it for him?
In FBI lingo, Greg Scarpa was a top echelon source because he was a main figure in his Columbo crime family. And to have him talking to you, as the FBI did for many years, was considered a big feather in your cap. And the allegation was that Scarpa was able to basically seduce DeVecchio with his quality intelligence and get him to start participating in his crimes. And they also alleged that he shared in money as well.
And the evidence for the allegations was pretty much confined to the testimony of Linda Shearer. And on the stand this week, she was a pretty impressive witness. But you had interviewed Shearer 10 years ago for a book project, and you knew that something was amiss.
A whole lot. Three of the four murders that she was putting in Linda Vecchio's mouth, she'd never even mentioned to us his involvement. And two of them, when I went back and dug out an old cardboard box and looked at the transcripts I'd made back then and listened to the tapes, I was astonished to see that she had explicitly told us when we'd asked her whether or not he'd had any involvement with two of the murders. She said absolutely not. One of the quotes was, "Lynn didn't do that. I know it for a fact."
Now, you had obtained this interview back in the 90s under a quite explicit guarantee of anonymity for Shearer, so you were in a bit of a bind as a reporter. How did you decide to come forward with your evidence in the form of your piece for the Village Voice?
With great difficulty, Bob. I struggled with this for a long time because, as you know, journalists, part of our stock in trade is getting people to talk to us, and confidentiality is crucial to that, being able to tell someone, if you tell me something, I will not reveal your identity. I won't reveal the information came from you. In this case, the source had breached her own confidentiality by first going to the grand jury and then testifying publicly. Apparently, whatever concerns she had had back in 1997 when she spoke to us, she'd gotten rid of. The other issue that remains is that once I realized, and I realized this when the trial first opened, that she was going to be the only eye and ear witness to the actual crimes that Linda Vecchio was charged with, I realized that I probably held the only real exonerating evidence that existed.
Is it your belief that, in general, putting this case aside for a moment, an agreement with an anonymous source is voided when the person either goes public or gives a different account of the same circumstances?
Not automatically. It's a general sense that there's an unwritten rule that when you agree to speak to someone confidentially, there's a contract of truth there, and that if your person you're talking to lies to you, all bets are off. In this case, I think that what trumped the confidentiality vow were what was weighing in the balance, a guy's life, the rest of his natural life in prison. To me, doing the right thing ultimately means acting as a citizen. If I don't come forward and the guy ends up being convicted, I don't want to live with that.
Now, the argument against what you've done is that all journalists in the future will have more difficulty getting information from anonymous sources who can now legitimately fear that the journalist will renege. Anything you wish to say to all future journalists who are going to have a harder time because you chose to save DeVecchio from life in prison?
I don't think I accept the premise, Bob. I mean, I do believe that the general public, the people we deal with and we talk to, understand the outer limits of this rule. Confidentiality of sources where someone risks their job, where people risk life and limb, they understand that there is a certain line in the sand beyond which you're not going to go. I don't think this is going to make it harder in the future. I would hope that, if anything, it kind of brings us back into the real world that everybody else lives in, which is that we try to do the right thing. It's just what I think I did here.
All right, Tom. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tom Robbins is a reporter with The Village Voice.
Sometimes it seems as if the internet offers little but a series of echo chambers where like-minded people fulminate among themselves. But there is one gigantic forum that is a virtual free-for-all, especially when it comes to one of the hottest topics of the day, God. That forum, of course, is YouTube. In this weekend's New York Times Magazine, Virginia Heffernan focuses not on the most viewed YouTube clips, but on the ones that generate the most comments. Some are what you'd expect, kind of dumb. For instance, this is the second most discussed clip in which a YouTuber named Chris Crocker rages over the media's treatment of Britney Spears.
What you don't realize is that Britney's making you all this money and all you do is write a bunch of crap about her. Leave Britney alone!
The comments on that clip mostly mock the emotional Britney fan. But the number one most commented on video is this one.
بين الهمجية والعقلانية إنه صراع بين الحرية والقمع بين الديمقراطية والديكتاتورية.
It's Wafa Sultan with subtitles on Al Jazeera discussing what she calls the backwardness of Islam. Virginia Heffernan explains that the conversation that's grown out of that clip is pretty sophisticated.
That's a video that has prompted 200,000 comments and counting. If you read that commentary, you get a sense that these YouTubers are not interested in music videos. They're not interested in the cat videos that get laughed at all the time or the skateboard crashes. They are interested in trying to figure out whether, in this case, Samuel Huntington's thesis about the clash of civilizations has any merit or not.
When there are 200,000 comments for one clip, is there any way for a conversation to emerge, or is it really just an avalanche of responses?
The comments that follow some of the most viewed videos are often just one-liners. Someone will write, "This is funny," or "Wow." But the comments on the truth about Islam from an ex-Muslim lady are dominated by very carefully composed paragraphs by characters. I think of them as characters because I've read most of the 200,000 comments and they have real personality. Characters who keep coming back to the conversation, to keep fighting, basically, keep arguing with other commenters. And essentially a narrative emerges, disputes and alliances among the people who want to talk about Islam and the future of civilization.
But would you say that the level of discourse is high, or would you say it's like any discourse on YouTube, low, middle, and high?
I would definitely say low, middle, and high. I mean, what it brought to mind for me is sort of 18th century disputes. If you think about the way Pope and Dryden would talk on the one hand in very bawdy terms about the—
I think about it all the time.
All right. Well, I'm a dork, but that is something that it brought to mind here. So they talk in like this kind of phony grandiloquence. These are the YouTubers. This very high tone. I don't even know what to associate it with. Heavy metal. It's sort of like Spinal Tap or something. And then they dip into, you know, just invective. And these people call each other zygotes and they call each other fetuses. And they have these like these, I don't know, very pointed kind of criticism that doesn't turn up other places in popular culture.
And we should point out that a lot of these responses are not in text. This being YouTube, people can upload video responses. Here's one response to the much discussed clip titled Atheism.
Salutations. I believe I have found the Achilles heel of atheism. Okay, I talked about Kant's criticism of the ontological proof of God's existence. I went through Anselm to Descartes, and I talked about Hume's criticism.
Do you think this adds another level of depth to the back and forth, or is it just really people reading what they would have otherwise have just written in a comment?
Just like the commenters pay a lot of attention to how they craft their comments and responses, in the video responses, people are even more attentive to form, how their title cards come up and how they edit their video. We've all studied commercials and movie trailers for a long time. So people want to try their hand at essentially what is making propaganda.
In your piece, you also took a look at explicitly religious analogs to YouTube, notably GodTube. Was the nature of the conversation on GodTube very, very different because the people likely to be reading it and using it are more homogeneous?
Yeah, GodTube does nothing if not preach to the converted. GodTube's slogan is broadcast him. And if you're looking at the site itself, people are posting videos, say, of a little girl reciting Psalm 23 in a kind of cute way or some excerpts from sermons. And the comments, they never disagree with the content of what's in the clip. But a lot of users of GodTube want to discuss which videos are most effective, the same things that people might talk about on Madison Avenue or in Hollywood. How do you sell God in short videos.
So this is about tactics and strategy, not about theology or belief.
That's exactly right. One of the filmmakers who's become sort of a face of GodTube says that he could have gone to work for Hollywood, but he wanted to put his skills as a videographer to work for God, for his religion, and that creating videos that, once again, are like propaganda videos were what he was called to.
We often hear that the internet may ultimately end up as just a series of cells, a series of unconnected echo chambers where people can never hear an idea that they didn't already embrace. But you have a place like YouTube where it seems you can either throw stones or you can pull up a chair. In other words, you can actually have that accidental encounter with people who don't agree with you. Do you think that this speaks to a different potential future for the internet after all?
I think YouTube is an incredibly exciting development that is very much against the kind of stratification that you discussed, where people will simply remain with their own, the kind of thing you see happening on Facebook a little bit, where you only ever have to talk to friends or friends of friends at worst. YouTube, it's a sort of metropolitan idea of, you know, that you'll really run into and discover a friction with people who are very unlike you. Part of what's amazing about it is because YouTube uses a visual language, you can even have discussions via video with people with whom you literally don't have a common language. For instance, one of the most widely discussed videos is something with an entirely Turkish name that I won't try to pronounce, but the images it shows are cartoons. They're anti-Islam cartoons, and they are legible even to me. So working with icons, working with spectacles from nature, people make cases and arguments that are amazingly readable, even if you don't share a language with the uploader.
Virginia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Virginia Heffernan writes a column called The Medium in the New York Times Magazine.
What with all the bad behavior we report in media and government, we well understand this show can get a little depressing. Well, at least this one time, we bring you the most wonderful news. In a Zogby 463 communications poll released this week, 11% of all Americans said they'd be willing to have a brain implant giving their thoughts access to the internet. This is obviously a great boon to brain implant activists and all others who believe that Microsoft Explorer is just not quite dehumanizing enough. But the poll's even more encouraging revelation is that despite all the breast-beating and gnashing of teeth by social scientists and psychologists, the online world is apparently not a contributor to American society's loneliness and isolation. On the contrary, it may well be the remedy. 24% of respondents said the internet could be a satisfactory substitute for a mate. Duh! You can chat on it, go to the movies on it, laze around on a Sunday with the New York Times with it. If you're digitally adept, you can certainly have sex with it, and without all that annoying hugging afterwards. About the only function of a significant other it can't approximate is actual procreation, which is why after these poll results, the Republicans will probably try to add the internet to the Defense of Marriage Act. But maybe they should think twice. If Senators Larry Craig and David Vitter had managed their loneliness online instead of the analog way, nobody would be the wiser. Besides, while the old paradigm of human mate looks nice in campaign commercials and so forth, it does not come with free email.
If you like surfing on YouTube, playing poker till dawn, if you dig Paris Hilton or the skankiest porn, if your life starts at midnight like some freak in a cape, then I'm the love that you looked for. Log on and escape.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Wallow, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer, with help from Andrea Ambrose and Paul Schneider. We had help from Ian Whitehead and Jessica McGaldy, our webmaster, is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.